So we have three speakers for today, Noah Tucker and Sarah Kendzior, who are both also associated to the Central Asia Program, and Courtney Ransom, who is working with them on this Digital Islam project. So the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you to Marlene for organizing this event. And I will get started. Okay, it's working. You're looking at a screenshot of an Uzbek social media network called Mulukot, which means dialogue in Uzbek. In many ways, Mulukot is no different than other social networks you see on the web. Uzbeks can use Mulukot to find friends, share music, post photos, and form groups based around common interests. The difference between Mulukot and other social networking sites is that it is unlikely anyone in this room could join it. In order to use Mulukot, which was created by the Uzbek government, you must register using an Uzbek phone number. In order to get an Uzbek phone number, you must present an Uzbek passport. This registration requirement makes it easy for the government to track Mulukot users, but surveillance is only one of the Uzbek government's goals. More than a method of state control, Mulukot is a form of ethnic containment. Mulukot was created in response to a problem facing the Uzbek government: the emergence of a lively, dynamic Uzbek language internet populated not just by Uzbeks from Uzbekistan, but Uzbeks living abroad and Uzbeks native to neighboring Central Asian states like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Today, these different groups of Uzbeks, once separated by geography, share ideas and information on the internet. Language, not citizenship, has become the passport for entry. The ability of Uzbeks to communicate across borders has proven a problem for the regime of Islam Karimov, which derives its moral authority from an ideology predicated on territorial nationalism. The Karimov regime has gone to great lengths to prevent Uzbeks in Uzbekistan from interacting with and reading the works of Uzbeks abroad. Internet censorship in Uzbekistan is as philosophical as it is practical. What Uzbeks in the diaspora often see as a stateless medium beyond government control, the Karimov regime views as a virtual extension of its sovereign dominion. In this presentation, I'll discuss Uzbek online communities that have emerged in the last few years and how the Uzbek government has responded to them. But first, a bit of background on internet use in Uzbekistan. Over the past few years, internet use in Uzbekistan has skyrocketed. In April 2013, roughly 9.5 million citizens of Uzbekistan, or about 30% of the population, were alleged to be online. This is a significant jump from 2009, when roughly 4.6 million Uzbeks were online, and from 2008, when 2.5 million were online. As the number of Uzbeks online has increased, so have state prohibitions on internet use. Uzbekistan currently has the most severe restrictions on internet use in Central Asia. The government uses blocks, filters, monitoring, and intimidation to keep citizens from freely accessing the internet, and justifies these policies under the pretext of protecting Uzbek national values. Many Uzbeks in Uzbekistan access the internet from cyber cafes, where their activity is monitored by officers from the SNB, Uzbekistan's heir to the KGB, which determine which sites are banned. Attempts to access forbidden sites are met with fines, as you can see here, and harassment. Wait till Nafahor gets her photo before I can send you if you need it. All right. Despite this, because we need to move into this one, the government of Uzbekistan promotes itself as an advocate of internet freedom. In a public address in 2011, President Karimov proclaimed, "We fully support the desire of our fellow citizens to freely use the internet. We absolutely do not accept the establishment of any walls or restrictions in the internet in the information world that lead to isolation." He then added, "At the same time, we must not ignore the fact that destructive forces seeking to mislead young people with immature minds and naive views on life seek to exploit the possibilities of the internet for their own selfish purposes, leading to dire consequences." He noted that the only way to save Uzbekistan's society from destruction was to, quote, "educate the youth to distinguish from black and white, friend and foe, and increase awareness of what he called the spirit of national and universal values." So what kind of values is the Uzbek government trying to promote, and who do they believe is threatening them? The ideas and values promoted by the Uzbek government are often the same ones promoted by most Uzbeks, including even Uzbeks in the political opposition. Most advocate things like the preservation and promotion of Uzbek language and culture, adherence to the Uzbek constitution, and the sanctity of family. The conflict between the Uzbek government and its purported enemies is not about ideas. It's about who has the right to express them and where. One example of this is the government's censorship of Wikipedia. In January 2012, the government banned all pages in Uzbek, but left pages in other languages open, including Russian. The ban did not prevent citizens from accessing political information, but instead blocked access to articles about Uzbek national heroes and pop stars. In short, exactly the kind of bland and patriotic content encouraged by the state. Here are a few examples. The first here is the Uzbek Wikipedia entry for the pop singer Kelly Clarkson, which gives an extensive overview of her life and work. By comparison, here's the 2012 entry for Karimov, the president of Uzbekistan, which is at the time, as you can see, perfunctory and devoid of detail. There is relatively little political material on the Uzbek Wikipedia, not because the government censors it, but because Uzbeks are hesitant to write online about political affairs. The Uzbek language Wikipedia couldn't have better fit the needs of the government if they had created it themselves, so why censor it? Part of the reason may have had to do with the addition of sexual terms that state censors may have found offensive. But that still leaves the question of why the Russian Wikipedia remained open when it contained even more offensive content. Here it's useful to analyze not only what is being censored, but where, because the question of where content exists online is more complex for authoritarian regimes that derive their power from narrow definitions of nationalism. Under Uzbek government logic, state intervention is more justified when Uzbeks write encyclopedia entries in Uzbek than when they read encyclopedia entries in Russian, because those entries do not lie on the state's ethnically demarcated virtual territory. By censoring the Uzbek language Wikipedia, state authorities marked an ambiguous collaborative state space as state property, property subject online, as it is on the ground, to strict government control. So now I'll tell you a bit about what Uzbeks outside Uzbekistan are doing online. This is a picture of Bahadir Choriev, a refugee from Uzbekistan who lives in St. Louis, Missouri. Bahadir works as a truck driver, but is best known as the leader of the Birdamlik People's Movement, the first Uzbek political party to develop primarily in the digital age. Bahadir spends his days traveling the United States in what he calls his mobile office, a computer workstation in his truck, which he uses to communicate with and recruit Uzbeks from around the world. First formed in Uzbekistan in 2004, Birdamlik really took off in 2005 when Bahadir was forced into exile and obtained regular internet access for the first time. Over the past 10 years, Birdamlik has grown from a few dozen activists in Uzbekistan to thousands of Uzbeks around the world, with branches in the U.S. and over 20 countries in Europe and Central Asia, connected almost solely through the internet. For Uzbeks, the internet is arguably more important than for other diaspora groups, as they are scattered widely around the world with no central relocation site abroad. The case of the Birdamlik movement highlights the complexities of Uzbek internet politics. On one hand, Birdamlik successfully used the internet to recruit members and help Uzbeks abroad. One Uzbek refugee who fled to Kyrgyzstan had never seen a computer before leaving Uzbekistan, but now credits both the internet and Birdamlik for saving his life. In hiding in Bishkek, he discovered the Birdamlik movement online and eventually became a noted contributor to its website. In 2009, he received asylum in France, a victory he credits to the Uzbeks he met online who helped him translate documents, petition officials, and negotiate the complex refugee system. Yet Birdamlik's use of the internet had its downside as well. The internet has exacerbated pre-existing feuds between Uzbek dissident groups, who are no more immune to the problems of online anonymity and trolling than anybody else. Uzbek dissidents have used the internet to broadcast their protests against the regime, but one of Birdamlik's biggest protests is the one pictured here, which was held against Radio Free Europe, who they accused of giving too much press to rival dissident parties. The most serious limitations of the internet for Uzbek politics were made clear in 2009. When Bahadir decided to return to Uzbekistan out of concern that he and the organization, while well-known online, were losing credibility in the ground. In October 2009, Bahadir arrived home for the first time in 5 years, only to embark on a disastrous journey. After confiscating his computer, the SNB trailed Bahadir around Uzbekistan, attacking the people he met with and preventing others from speaking with him. This slide shows one of the few public communications he was able to make during his month in Uzbekistan, an update to his Facebook page where he discusses how he and other Birdamlik members were arrested and attacked. Bahadir had returned to Uzbekistan to boost credibility, but his presence in the country robbed him of any way to relay his message to supporters. He went from being the creator of online political discourse to its object. He could not reach Uzbeks outside Uzbekistan, and he could not reach Uzbeks inside Uzbekistan either, as any attempt he made to do so was blocked by state officials. This is the dilemma of exile in the internet age. To be in Uzbekistan means to be unable to participate in Uzbek politics and unable to access information about what's happening around you. To be outside of Uzbekistan means to be able to engage in contentious politics and be better informed on political developments in Uzbekistan, but to be constantly reminded that you are alienated from the people you left behind. You also run the risk of endangering your relatives even if you can speak freely. In June 2013, Bahadir announced on a website that he intended to run for president of Uzbekistan and reiterated his critiques of the Uzbek government. A few weeks later, his 71-year-old father, Hassan Choriev, was arrested and jailed in Uzbekistan on fabricated charges. The move was intended to silence Bahadir and send a message to Uzbek activists abroad that online words will have real-life consequences in Uzbekistan, if not for the individual who said them, then for those whom he loves. This tactic of punishing loved ones for the perceived crimes of the individual is one of the most pervasive and effective of the Uzbek regime. In March 2014, Hassan Choriev died, a few months after having been released from an Uzbek prison after 7 months in custody. His family believes that his time in prison exacerbated his health problems and caused his death. The Choriev family could not go to their father's funeral. Instead, they grieved from America, mourning with relatives online, knowing that their mourning itself was monitored by the state. Throughout this presentation, I've described ways that Uzbeks in and outside Uzbekistan are kept separate through government intervention. And now I'll discuss the places where they mix. The first example I'm showing you is Arbuz. Launched in the late 1990s, Arbuz became a gathering place for Uzbeks in and outside Uzbekistan to talk about popular topics like food, sports, national customs, and entertainment. In 2005, when the Uzbek government fired on a massive protest in the city of Andijan, killing hundreds of bystanders, Arbuz turned into something else, a place for Uzbeks to exchange forbidden information. Uzbeks from outside Uzbekistan relayed reports from BBC and other media sites. Uzbeks inside Uzbekistan relayed rumors they heard on the ground. Though few on Arbuz would define themselves as activists, most avoided or even hated politics, the forum ended up becoming an essential site of Uzbek political discourse. The same thing happened again in 2010. That summer, riots in southern Kyrgyzstan killed hundreds of Uzbeks and briefly sent tens of thousands into Uzbekistan. Uzbeks from both Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan used Arbuz to comment on the riots, criticizing both the Uzbek and Kyrgyz governments for not protecting Uzbek people. This ability of Uzbeks to talk over state lines and to discuss events that neither government wanted publicized led to Uzbekistan's officials shutting down Arbuz in 2011. Because the site was hosted abroad, the Uzbek government could not arrest its owner. Instead, they arrested people who used it in Uzbekistan. The owner responded at first by removing political content, including all the threads about Andijan and Osh. But in the end, even selective censorship did not quell fears of state retaliation. In December 2011, the owner shut down Arbuz permanently out of concern for user safety. The Arbus closure serves as a reminder that, in Uzbekistan, self-censorship is as powerful as state censorship. With their central meeting place abandoned, where did Uzbeks turn for conversation? Mostly to social media websites, where they were able to engage in the sort of free-form discussion that had shaped Arbus. In the summer of 2011, several Uzbek groups were created on Facebook that revolved around issues that could never be openly discussed in Uzbekistan, like questions and answers about religion, or can the Uzbek mentality be changed, which is shown here. It was at this time that the government created Mulakot, the social network I showed you earlier, in an attempt to limit the ability of Uzbeks to share ideas and information. Once able to insulate itself from Uzbeks living outside state lines, the Uzbek government must now contend with a diverse and increasingly outspoken diaspora. In recent years, the state's method of handling this problem has shifted from censorship to containment to violence. Like the internet itself, this violence transcends Uzbekistan's borders. In 2007, Alisher Saipov, an Uzbek online journalist, was shot to death in Osh by Uzbek state agents. Notably, Saipov was not a citizen of Uzbekistan. He was an ethnic Uzbek from Kyrgyzstan who wrote critical articles about Uzbekistan online. In the weeks before the assassination, the Uzbek state media wrote articles about Saipov, calling him a traitor to Uzbeks. In their view, he did not respect Uzbekistan's, quote, informational borders, and as a result, he was considered fair game abroad. In recent years, similar attacks have been aimed at other Uzbeks abroad, most notably the Imam Obidhun Khori Nazarov, who was shot in February 2012 in Sweden. He was well known in Uzbekistan and had maintained his following by posting videos of his sermons on YouTube, where they were viewed by Uzbeks around the world. In conclusion, the efforts of the Uzbek government to control the internet are not just about Uzbekistan. The internet poses a serious challenge to the Karimov regime because it allows a geographically dispersed but culturally and linguistically cohesive population of Uzbeks to interact. In response, Uzbek state officials have recast the boundaries of ethnic belonging, but in a way that subsumes all ethnic Uzbeks under the control of Uzbekistan. They see the Uzbek language internet as a continuation of the Uzbek state, with those who use it for politics subject to punishment and persecution. Thanks.
Thank you. Do we...
We should do all the presentations.
Yeah, and
then
have the kind of
they fit
discussion.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to explain the logic of the way they fit together, I guess it's like in the order of the title. Sarah's presentation about politics and social media in general starts us off, and then I'm going to talk about a subset of this, a lot of really similar issues for how people talk about religion online and the problems that this creates for the government and the methods that they try to develop in order to stop people from talking about religion on the internet in ways they don't like. And then Courtney is going to talk about conflict. And then at the end, we'll just wait for your questions to show the way that these fit together. Okay. So most of you can guess the context for this picture without the caption, because the Syrian chemical attacks that killed hundreds of innocent civilians in August last year and nearly led the U.S. into another war will likely be remembered as one of the most important events of the decade. And there are only one tragedy among so many others in Syria. Whether they see it as a human tragedy or politics or a clash of religions, much of the world's public, especially in the Muslim world, feels affected by this desperate conflict. It might not be a surprise to most people in this room, however, that for the Uzbek media, the most important world news event of last year simply didn't happen. For weeks, it had never happened, just like the Arab Spring protests in 2011 didn't happen for months. As many of you already know, this is not an unusual pattern, especially when it comes to popular uprisings, protests, or rebellions that would imply that ordinary people might have some agency. When pressed to comment on the Syrian war, the Deputy Mufti of Uzbekistan described the whole thing as a big misunderstanding. But it may surprise you to know that as the weeks wore on, one Uzbekistani Islamic public figure broke hard with that line. Adham Atajanov, better known by his screen name Abu Muslim, cautiously began publishing articles on one of the sites he administers in Uzbekistan that covered the international diplomatic standoff in a way that viewed the bloody civil war in Syria and the chemical massacre sympathetically to the Syrian public. At first, he republished articles from Voice of America that were likely safe because they highlighted the perspective of many Americans who were against U.S. intervention in the conflict. But in early September, Abu Muslim dropped a bombshell on his large audience. In the first paragraphs of the article pictured here, ostensibly about regional political context for the conflict, Abu Muslim called the Arab Spring protest a legitimate popular response to corrupt and nepotistic dictators who oppressed their people. He went on to say that the Syrian conflict likely would have never descended into civil war if the Assad regime had not brutally suppressed peaceful protesters. It would be hard to exaggerate how stark the contrast is between what Abu Muslim wrote and the coverage in all of the rest of the Uzbekistan-based media or government talking points. So many have been jailed as terrorists or at least driven from the country for far less. But I want to use this as an example and the contrast that it illustrates to show that with religious speech, like all other types of speech in Uzbekistan, the line between permitted and persecuted is not so much in what is said, but in who's saying it. In Freedom House's terms, Uzbekistan is one of the most consolidated authoritarian regimes in the world, but it's not a totalitarian one. Even or especially in the discourse around Islam, there's room to speak, but only for the right people, for those who show sufficient loyalty to the state and who are willing to adhere to the government's talking points when pressed. But it's also a sign that on certain topics, like Islam, and issues that affect Muslims in a country where 96% of the people self-identify as such, the state recognizes that it cannot control the entire discourse, and also that it has competition. Abu Muslim, who we have a nice picture of him up there, we'll have more later, is not a journalist. If he were a journalist, he would be in jail. There's really no question about this. He sits at the helm of a digital Islamic publishing empire run by Central Asia's most famous Muslim scholar, Sheikh Mohammed Sadiq Mohammed Yusuf, the last mufti of Soviet Central Asia and the first of independent Uzbekistan, who's forced into exile in the early 1990s and coaxed back after the genesis of the IMU threat in 1999 to help the Karimov government manage the threat of political Islam and later of the internet itself. He's the last and only independent Islamic authority in the country. In exchange for loyalty to the state and for occasionally issuing public fatwas against the regime's archenemies, Sheikh Mohammed Sadiq has been allowed to rebuild his own muftiate in parallel to the one from which he was removed in 1993. Though he cannot train imams or write official sermons, he can publish freely, and most of all, he's been given free rein to construct Uzbekistan's Islamic internet. Adham Atajanov, Abu Muslim, is his trusted tech-savvy disciple. He oversees an ever-growing network of now more than 20 Islamic internet portals geared toward every possible audience and among the most visited websites in the .uz domain. In exchange for the occasional rant accusing a political enemy of spreading, quote, homosexual propaganda that offends Islam, Abu Muslim can praise a popular uprising against a dictator he describes in a way that sounds eerily like Islam Karimov. The fact that this web empire exists and that the powerful Uzbek government has to allow someone like Abu Muslim to run it, I would argue, is a quiet recognition of failure on the part of the state. That in the internet age, full control of information is simply not possible and is becoming less possible all the time. Abu Muslim's Islamic internet has to be allowed to exist because in spite of everything the government has tried, another Uzbek Islamic internet already does. And that's what we're going to talk about now. The state's original, or perhaps clearly preferred, approach to controlling Islamic information and religious teaching it found threatening was just to eliminate the source. Most of us are probably familiar with the story of how in the mid-1990s and through even to the present day, as recently as 2012, the Uzbek government security services have gone about simply eliminating Islamic figures that they found too popular. These are some of the most the top three are some of the most influential of the 1990s Islamic revival in Uzbekistan. Abduvali Khoury disappeared in 1995. He's presumed dead since then. Obidxon Khoury managed to leave the country and lived in hiding for years, resurfaced in rural Sweden, and as Sarah mentioned, was shot in the head outside of his apartment. So even that far was not far enough. Mohammed Rafiq Khoury was killed. He's the only one of these who the Uzbek security services openly admit that they shot and killed, but claim that he was riding in a car full of IMU people. And then others, like Abdullah Bukhari, who's a person I'm really interested in, but we won't have a lot of time to talk about today, had to go into self-exile because they were interested in these men, they were listening to their sermons, they were interested in Islam at all and wanted to practice it in the way that they thought was right rather than what the government told them. So as some of these men and their followers and their families fled into exile, often the first thing that they did was to continue their religious education and activity and use their new freedom to construct networks of websites where they could store and preserve independent Uzbek Islamic voices well outside of the reach of the state. Another function of new media, just like what Sarah outlined in her presentation on politics, is to preserve, reproduce, and allow access to independent voices on religion, just like politics, who've been repressed or banned by the Uzbek government. In spite of Uzbekistan's impressive censorship efforts and willingness to use state violence to silence voices it dislikes, whose positions and popularity it finds threatening, internet-based new media has ensured that the work of popular Uzbek Muslim clerics and thinkers remains easily accessible even after their death or assassination. So one of the first things that they do, that they did, as they went abroad and the social media age sort of began with YouTube and other video hosting services, was to gather together all of the existing videos of sermons that they could. Say, for example, of Abduvali Khoury, who's probably the most popular sort of and authoritative of the Uzbek now internet imams, in spite of the fact that he's probably been dead since before the internet age began. But if you go to YouTube, you can find over 2,000 unique hits on there's only about 40 sermons, but these have been copied and spread over so many different sites and places that they become impossible to censor. Some of the more tech-savvy disciples who are interested have actually, I've seen in places, hacked into commercial servers in other places and just taken little bits of it. They just take a little bit of space in order to save a file on there, and then they can send one another or send other friends an HTML address for that exact place. And so you can watch an Abduvali Khoury sermon that's stored, say, for example, by the Columbus, Ohio Rotary Club, but they have no idea that they're hosting an Abduvali Khoury sermon. And so when you, from inside Uzbekistan, type in that address, all the government censors see is that you're looking at the Columbus, Ohio Rotary Club, which is kind of a strange thing to do. But they have no idea that you're listening to a sermon by a cleric that they've murdered. So this is one of the first uses that they put it to, just preserving this raw material that they had left. The next one, as years went on and they became a little bit more sophisticated with the technology and had time to gather more material, was to create this pretty impressive network of media hubs where people can find all kinds of information about Islamic education. This is a good example of one, a site called Talaba. A lot of these appear to have some sort of sponsorship. People talk about them, that they're also sponsored by Saudi Arabia or by these various religious organizations, but most of them won't say. And the content is very general for the most part. One of the things that they concentrate on is making books available, because this is another serious problem for Uzbek Muslims inside Uzbekistan and in other places where they are living, especially as an ethnic minority. They don't have a printing press to print religious literature for them. They've made pretty impressive libraries, and they take all kinds of books now that over the years have been translated into Uzbek by these Uzbeks living in exile, and then they convert them into these flash libraries. And any one of these, you know, several dozen sites that we're talking about, you can open up into a library and find 100 or 200 books, general religious interest, educational titles that haven't been available inside Uzbekistan, have never before been available in the Uzbek language. So this is part of the internet community that they wanted to construct. And these are also very handy to download just onto your mobile phone. They work very well for that. So they have overcome, in the space of just a couple of years, they've undone really a whole lot of government censorship and book burning efforts and this sort of thing. The next level that they went to is to create these what we call branded media studios. And in many cases, these they'll take videos that already exist that are created by other media studios, usually stuff that was available in Arabic by these dawah, these evangelical organizations, and we'll translate them into Uzbek. We don't know exactly where the funding or where the support for this kind of thing comes from, because they're sort of careful not to talk about that or even where these are hosted. But they make a wealth of material that's available to other Muslims in the Middle East and living through the rest of the world, available in Uzbek as well. And most of these, like this one, are very similar, actually, to what I say on a personal note. I grew up, I was raised in the evangelical church in the United States, and this stuff reminds me so much of stuff that we were shown at youth group when I was a kid. This particular video is one of these. There's a dozen different versions of this in multiple religions, where the guy is shown talking on his cell phone, he sleeps, he hits the snooze button instead of going to prayer, he's smoking, he's drinking, he's out having fun with his friends, he gets in a terrible graphic car accident, and he died, the doctors are trying to save him, he dies in the hospital, and then he gets to come back to Earth for just a few moments to beg his former self to straighten up his act and go to prayer on time so that he doesn't die and go to hell. And this is a very, like I said, there are so many of these things that are very similar across evangelizing or proselytizing religions, where they're all using the technology in the same way. And actually, here from the last slideshow, I had this as an example. This is something my brother shared on Facebook a couple of months ago, and I've seen this exact meme for the Quran dozens of times, probably. So the parallels are striking. But this is the sort of thing. One of the other reasons I want to talk about this in particular is that we have this idea, and I'll talk a little bit later about violent extremist groups and this sort of thing. You have this idea that there's this shadowy, independent Islamic internet out there, that all of it is going to be extremism and Al-Qaeda and that kind of thing. And that's there, and we'll talk about this for a minute. But the vast majority of it is this. It's people trying to encourage other Uzbeks to become more pious, to make Islam a part of their daily life, to read their Quran as often as they read their cell phone, you know, this kind of thing. There's a great deal of, it's true, there's, you know, money from Saudi religious organizations and things like that that are being poured into this, but most of it is to this end, certainly not to the extremist groups. As they were able to form sort of larger communities and the sites interact with one another, another one of the things that they've done very commonly is to put up fatwa forums for people who often are living in exile and living abroad, where they don't have access to a local imam who can speak their own language. They can use, they can write in through the internet site to when they have questions about how to properly practice their faith. So there's a lot of these are just everyday ethical and moral questions from a Muslim standpoint. So this one is a common theme. What are the ethics of talking to a girl on chat? This one is a more specific and maybe slightly less common theme about migrant workers who have to live separate, husbands and wives who have to live separated from one another for most of the year. A question, an important ethical question that comes up is, how do they continue to have an intimate relationship over a long distance? And they They don't know. They want to know what's the proper Islamic etiquette for this. What is allowed and what's not allowed. And these are very personal questions. They're kind of embarrassing questions sometimes. But this is what people use these resources for. Even in this kind of thing, the Uzbeks who turn to these sites are very concerned about not sinning, about doing this right. How do I be a good Muslim? This is really what most of these resources are devoted to. Then, sort of in the third category of these sites, we have voices that were strongly prescribed inside Uzbekistan. So Abidhan Karim Nazarov is a good example of this, as Sarah has already covered this when he was in Sweden. He and his disciples set up a really large internet resource, and he did these same kind of things. He answered these same sort of questions. A subset of another project that Sarah and I did on Uzbeks in Osh, we had a lot of really interesting questions that Uzbeks there, after the ethnic conflict, wrote in to ask Imam Obidhan Kuri, is it right to take revenge after Kyrgyz have murdered my family? You know, is it right for me to leave a Muslim country, Kyrgyzstan, even though I'm being treated badly here? This is a Muslim country. Is it right for me? Is it ethical for me to leave here and live in a non-Muslim country, even if I'm treated badly? These are the kind of really complicated questions that people just don't have local resources to answer, and so they turn to the internet. Other groups like Hizb-e-Tahrir that are very categorically banned in Uzbekistan and want to combine Islam and politics are also present and are increasingly successful at getting their message out through social media and reaching, I think, arguably far more people than they ever were before when they were on the ground. And then, of course, at the far end of the spectrum, we have violent groups like the IMU, who are more than okay with using political violence to further their own means. And we have groups like their splinter group, the IJU, who run a very interesting website that appears to be a news and analytical resource. And so they don't openly say that they're affiliated with the IJU. They purport to provide people world news from an Islamic perspective, but then when you look in their library, they have books by Anwar al-Awlaki and Al-Qaeda manuals and things like that. They interview the Al-Qaeda strategy chief on how to conduct guerrilla warfare and things like this. So they're not... Once you get inside the site a little bit, it's not hard to tell where you are. But at the same time, they're also very careful to try to pull in as many people as they can by hiding this affiliation and sort of getting people through the door and then springing the other stuff on them. So far we've talked mostly about what we'd call Internet 1.0, which is these websites. And none of this really mattered all this much, especially to the Uzbek authorities, until recently, because Internet penetration rates were low. And Uzbekistan had constructed a system of firewalls and blocks that could identify any one of these web-based media platforms as an isolated website and block them pretty effectively. The sites were fairly disparate and they were little known. It was tough to find them even through a Google search, because Google Uzbek is not super great, big surprise, unless you already knew where to look for them. So this was a small community of people who probably already knew one another. You found out about this website through your friends, not through internet advertising or something like that. But then two things changed more or less simultaneously that radically altered the Uzbek Islamic internet. The first is a massive growth in migrant labor. And the second is that migrants join social networking sites like Adna Klasniki, shown here, and Facebook, often over mobile phones, which are much cheaper to access and considered sort of an absolute necessity for life when you're living as a migrant laborer in Russia. And they have more advanced 3G networks. Now, things have sort of evened out now with Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, but as of a couple of years ago, you had much better phone internet access in Russia or in Sweden than you did back at home. So this is a screenshot of a video that's a convenient example for both of these trends at once. It's called The Two Slaves. It's about migration and the abuse that migrant laborers suffer, especially in Russia, and argues that Central Asians, the video says there are 2 million of them working in Moscow alone, are treated terribly. The first half of the video is about human rights abuses and all of the familiar but very terrible things that Central Asian labor migrants go through inside Russia. that the basic argument is that if you go to Russia and you become a migrant laborer there, you're going to become a slave to the Russians. But you have an alternative. You can be a slave to Allah. You can be a slave to God. You can embrace this other identity. And this is the sort of thing that's it's targeted toward a very specific audience who can access it, and message of in a pretty sophisticated way to a particular audience who tend to be receptive to this. That video and many others like it are posted a lot of times on big general interest groups that are on, say, Odnoklassiki, for example. This one loosely translates like to just interesting stories and legends or something like that. It's just a big general interest group that has all kinds of stuff on it. It's got 65,000 members, and it says that it's based in the city of Namangan. We don't know if that's entirely true or not. But so here we have this video, and this is the sort of thing that circulates very commonly. But once you get to the end of the video, it turns out that it was made by the IJU. And the ultimate message at the end of that video is, if you want to be a slave to Allah, come to our camp and we'll hand you a gun and we'll teach you how to change the system. And so the extremist groups who really occupy just the tiny margins of this discussion, and in general really still occupy only the very small margins, have done very well with social media and being able to get their messages out to far more people and communicate more effectively with far more people. And the other thing is that Uzbekistan is not really sure what to do about social networking. Like Sarah highlighted in her presentation, one of the things that they've tried to do is create their own social network and get people to join that, and then obviously the IJU can't join it. But they've been hesitant so far to sort of walk this line in between. They know that social media and internet and technology development is important for developing the economy and being a player in the world. And so far, they've stopped short of just pulling the plug on Facebook or on the Klasniki. But using these systems rather than primarily using their website allows these groups to circumvent all of the censorship mechanisms that were in place. Everyone from political exile groups and independent media groups like Fergana News have figured this out. And so rather than posting links to their stories on Facebook or on the Klasiki, they'll post the full text of something so that those living inside Uzbekistan who can't get to that website can get to the content through their friend network on social networks. And extremist groups have figured this out as well. And they also have started to multiply in the last couple of years, especially coming back again to the Syrian conflict. This is now, you may never have heard of it before, this is called the Imam al-Bukhari Brigade. This is their website. They're now, I think, safe to say, probably by far the largest Uzbek violent extremist organization, probably 3 to 4 times larger than the IMU and the IJU, but most people have never heard of them still. But if you're on the internet and you're friends with anyone who talks about Islamic issues, you've probably heard of them because they're very good. They're very aggressive about friending. They're very good at getting their material out over the internet. So we have this whole network that's been constructed outside of Uzbekistan. We won't be able to talk about too much, and I'm getting close to the end here. But as people were sent out of Uzbekistan, they created all of these information networks out. And then the red ones are extremist groups, and the red lines are conflicts into which they are recruiting people. And so you see, you have all of this stuff. And then back here in Uzbekistan, we come back to the beginning of the presentation, and this is Abu Muslim and Islam Daruz. And he is linked to all of the rest of these people and is meant to be sort of the firewall from the independent Uzbek Islamic internet and the homemade, the homegrown one. And this is Uzbekistan's strategy for dealing with this, for finding a way to keep the rest of this stuff out and keep their people from being pulled into these conflicts. So this is why Adham Atajanov is allowed to be Abu Muslim. He's intended to be the gatekeeper, not just of the Muslim internet, but of social media as well. He uses his personal Facebook profile as a venue to promote articles from the Islam.uz websites, and the comments sections become a means of conversation. Only unlike the carefully monitored and administered internet forum run by Islam.uz, the Facebook feeds are available to everyone. Abu Muslim accepts friend requests from everyone, from the young students in Uzbekistan. His posts and articles are meant to mold and instruct Hizba Tahrir members in Russia and Europe, to ultra-conservative Salafis in the Middle East, and even self-identified members of the Islamic movement in Uzbekistan and Islamic Jihad Union. This creates an interesting and unprecedented, and I can add, unintended feedback loop, where the discourse, like it or not, is genuinely open to everyone and their ideas. It has perhaps surprising consequences for them. A couple of months ago, for example, I watched a thread unfold after Abu Muslim posted an article from one of the Islam.uz sites warning people against the dangers of Hizb ut-Tahrir and accusing them of some or another obscure theological heresy that allegedly made them bad Muslims, regardless of their politics. It was more or less a typical propaganda piece, met at first with a few curious comments from Muslims inside Uzbekistan trying to understand the legal minutiae in question, but then by a flood of Hizb ut-Tahrir members, long ago relegated to exile hundreds or thousands of miles away, defending their organization and providing ample proof from their official doctrinal statements that they believe no such thing. No one seemed to know quite how to react. They had no experience with this kind of debate as a two-way conversation. To his credit, Abu Muslim didn't delete the comments, and he didn't really try to argue back either. The process is slow and will almost certainly never be complete, but social media is leveling the playing field for Islamic activists from Central Asia, creating a semi-public space for debate that hasn't existed for Uzbek Muslims in the 20 years since Abdulwali Kuri disappeared from the Tashkent airport. But choices made for clearly political reasons in Tashkent have an immediate effect on the environment. Abu Muslim's social media platforms are now a gateway for Muslims with many different ideas about Islam and its role in society to dialogue with one another. But is he really the best person for the job? So this is him with his Uzbek bros down in Samarkand and riding a horse, this hex, lifting weights.
Putin style.
Putin style, that's right. So this is the guy who is supposed to keep that whole flood of information out of Uzbekistan, which is why I like this picture so much. He has several other kung fu poses, but this was one that I liked. This is all stuff, by the way. I mean, it's a little bit unfair of me to put this in the presentation, but this is right here on his page where he's having these conversations with his Batarir guys, where he's promoting the site. This is the same part of his persona. So in the meantime, other Uzbek scholars, for example, like this guy, Saifullah Nasir, who got a PhD in Islamic jurisprudence from the University of Medina, who's clearly probably vastly more qualified than Abu Muslim to have this kind of conversation about Islam and theology, are not allowed to go back to the country on risk of being jailed or killed as soon as they get back. And other people who are more popular and more influential, like Khairullah Humidov, who I've talked about in a lot of other contexts, are in jail because they were talking about the same things. There's no disagreement. There's no shade of theological disagreement between Abu Muslim and Khairullah Humidov. They were part of the same study group in Tashkent. They had the same teacher. But Humidov was not authorized to speak. And so he's a terrorist, and Abu Muslim is the gatekeeper for all of the Islamic internet. So I'm a little over time, but thank you so much.
For those who would like to enjoy more of Noah's research, you can just have a look at this is one of our first brief on the Facebook Jihad, and it's already online on Registan website, and it will be online on our website too, also tomorrow probably, or one of these days very soon.
So I'm actually not here to discuss Central Asia or Islam, so what am I doing here? I'm here to talk about Russian information practices because they tend to cross-fertilize into Central Asian information practices. Central Asians also borrow very heavily from the Chinese playbook as well. But what we can see is as Russian internet and information practices evolve, other countries follow suit. So that's why I'm here. So the current Russian media situation, they have almost complete control of television in the country through either state-owned corporations like the All-Russian Media Corporation that owns like all the first five channels, to state friends like Usmanov or Kovalchuk. And basically between the three of those, they own, let's say, 90% of all of the TV, including entertainment. The government also has direct input into every single news story and the entire agenda for news channels. And we'll see that later in a case study we're going to look at. They have ever-expanding control of print media and news agencies, and they have a growing arsenal of really questionable internet laws and media laws in general that are going to possibly allow them to basically block anything they darn well please. They have the ability to block everything from a single web page to the entire IP address, which could be multiple websites altogether. And they have an army of paid trolls, commentators, hooligans, what have you, that can go online and disrupt any conversation and tend to do so around any political topics. So TV, we already kind of talked about this, it's the most used and most trusted source of information, even though people know that it's tilted and biased. They still watch it the most, and they still, of all the information sources, trust it the most. And Levada Center actually found that the more they watch it, the more they trust it, surprisingly. Most Russians get their news from the three main channels, the Первый канал, Россия 1, and NTV. And very small numbers of people watch the independent channels. So only 17 to 18% watch RenTV, Euronews, and Dosht. And Dosht, by the way, recently had issues where they had a survey that was unfortunately unpopular, where they asked if some World War II actions were correct, and the state basically used that to kick them off federal TV and make them go all online. Russian TV also is extremely popular in all of the border countries, so you'll see that they also are watched in Central Asia and in Ukraine, for example. Moldova, Estonia, Lithuania, a lot of those countries are now banning them, by the way. We talked about how they issue instructions about what should be covered and how. And again, the ownership. You'll see Usmanov and Kovalchuk own a tremendous amount. So if you look at this chart, the dark blue is state government-owned. This medium blue is the Moscow City Station TV Center. And the light blue are owned by government-friendly enterprises like Gazprom Media or Kovalchuk, his STS. He has 25% of STS and everything else. So you can see that there's basically nothing left. So newspapers aren't really that widely read, kind of like the rest of the world. You know, specific newspapers appear to a very specific demographic, but they aren't that commonly read. The 400 daily newspapers tend to coordinate their coverage with the Kremlin. They don't really challenge them, which is not a good idea. The Kremlin owns all of the printing equipment as well, so you just don't want to do that. The state controls, either through Gazprom, which we talked about, Gazprom Media, or New Media Group, which belongs to Kovalchuk, all the most important national newspapers and news agencies. And in December, if you guys were watching, Putin closed down RIA Novosti, which was at least a semi-decent news agency that offered pretty unbiased coverage most of the time, and rolled it into a new news agency that they're calling Russia Today, not the TV station that you're used to, but the new head of the director of it will be the director of Russia Today that you do think of. And their main speaker, editor, what have you, is Dmitry Kiselyov, who's pretty famous for being rabidly anti-Western, anti-homosexuals, anti-everything. The man is pretty rabid on Ukraine as well, and I can find you a good quote from him about how the Swedes were involved because they wanted to take revenge for their defeat at Poltava in 1609. So the internet. Until recently, the internet was relatively free in Russia. It was kind of considered to be the pressure release valve, and the state really didn't bother it too much. And then we had the Bolotnaya protests that were mostly organized through social media and the internet. And then Ukraine happened, which also was organized through a lot of social media. And it really, I think, gave them a wake-up call and scared them. So in the last 2 years, they have passed a completely amazing number of laws covering social media, the internet, regular media, that would allow them to basically shut down anything. Most of the blocking that we've seen done using these laws, like the blacklist law we'll talk about, has been political. And that law was originally intended to be something to protect children, but they're using it to shut down sites like Grani.ru, which is an opposition newspaper from abroad, and Navalny's website. He's the main opposition leader right now. Kremlin allies also own significant stakes in most of the top Russian social networks. So not Facebook, although they had some, 5%, they sold it. But ВКонтакте, Одноклассники, Яндекс, of course. So, and of course, here's the chart. You probably can't see it, but Yandex is owned by Runet Holdings, but ВКонтакте is owned by Mail.ru Group, which belongs to Usmanov. Mail.ru, obviously. Одноклассники is another Mail.ru group. LiveJournal, Rambler.ru are owned by this new Rambler and Company conglomerate, which is controlled by Mammut. They used to be Potanin's. Not a big difference. He was Brooklyn, too. Sberbank, that's just a website, but it's a bank controlled by the Russian government. Let's see, what else do we have here? Haver and Ya.ru, which I think they're getting ready to close, and Lenta.ru. And if you saw, Lenta.ru's editor-in-chief got fired for an interview with the Pravi Sektor a few months ago. And the entire tone of the site has changed since then. So here are the laws that we're looking at. On July 4th of this year, the Duma passed the final draft of legislation that will require all websites that work in Russia to store personal data about Russian users only in Russia. Can't take any of it outside. So that means, for example, if you want to buy a plane ticket from Lufthansa, Lufthansa can't take that data that you provide, your name, your credit card number, any of that stuff, into their servers in Germany. They have to build a server farm or buy server space in Russia. So what a lot of people are saying is that the largest internet companies can probably afford to do that, especially in the time frame they've been given, 17 months, but most smaller internet companies can't. So that's a really big problem with that law. But what it will probably mean is that enforcement will be selective, and they will choose what they shut down, because then they have a right to shut down basically anything. On June 20th, also this year, the Duma passed a law recriminalizing, but making it illegal to retweet anything that they consider extremist. And you probably know that Russia has an extremely broad view of what is extremist. It can be anything from saying cops are pigs to saying that a Duma member is corrupt, and people have been prosecuted for that. And of course they do have problems with nationalists, so they do prosecute those as well, but the very vague definition of extremist makes this a problematic law. In 2012, the Duma passed this blacklist law, and it was originally intended to protect children from harmful information, being something like child pornography or how to commit suicide or how to use drugs or saying drugs are cool. And I feel like it was something that most people felt like they could get behind in the public, but many, many organizations warned at the time that it was going to be used for far worse. In fact, Wikipedia shut down its page and so did a few other websites for the day over that. They went ahead with it and they passed it. And then in December 2013, they expanded the kind of sites that can be done like this and included any sites that call for riots, extremist activities, or participation in unsanctioned protests. Who has unsanctioned protests in Russia? The opposition. So this means that any website that features those things, be it a retweet or direct post, Facebook, what have you, can be added to this list of sites and immediately blocked without a court order, just like so, by Roskomnadzor. The blogger's law requires any site with an audience of 3,000 or more people to register as mass media, which also means that it's going to be subject to Russian media laws. And that any organization that either hosts the site or has interactions with it has to record that user's actions, whatever they post, whatever they write to other people, and keep it for a minimum of 6 months. So that could target actually some of the most popular Russian bloggers. Most of them have way more than 3,000 fans. And in July 2012, we had recriminalization of defamation, and anybody who defames, like, for example, a Duma member could get up to 5 years in prison. So we can see this playing out in the conflict with Ukraine. Since the start of the unrest in Ukraine, Russia's state media has continually, repeatedly portrayed them as fascists and barbarians, and saying that their supporters are drug users and criminals and homosexuals and CIA stooges, sellouts, etc. The Russian group Anonymous International, they're a hacking collective, but they're not actually related to Anonymous, but they leaked what they claimed was from the presidential administration a prepackaged set of news stories for Russia's TV networks. So it went through on how they're supposed to cover the annexation of Crimea, justify it. They were supposed to laud President Putin's efforts to develop the region. They should talk about tourism because the region desperately needs tourists for its economy, and propagate an apocalyptic description of events in the Ukrainian heartland where criminals and fascists supposedly run wild. And boy, have they gone to town doing that, haven't they? And so this is what we saw. They were filled with images and reports of destroyed buildings, dead or injured children, illegal weapons, which that's supposed to be is a, I don't even know what it is in English, but a kasetnaya bomba, somebody help me. And
cluster bomb.
Cluster bomb, thank you. They also accused us of accused the Ukrainians of having used white phosphorus bombs against, I think it was Slavyansk. And yeah, basically covering the savagery of the Ukrainian army. But a lot of those reports have been revealed to be fake through clever crowdsourcing, including the white phosphorus one that was shown to be footage from the Iraq War. But their goals with all this are to demonize the Kiev authorities, to reinforce loyalty among the pro-Russian Ukrainians in the east of Ukraine, and to get support for their version of events and their subsequent actions at home. In Crimea in March, right before the annexation referendum, armed men seized the TV transmitters at the state firm that broadcast the Ukrainian television in the region and forced them to replace Ukrainian TV with Russian channels. And Russia 24 is, I think, where Kisilov was at the time. In April, pro-Russian militants seized a broadcasting tower near Slavyansk, again replacing Ukrainian TV with Russian TV and resulting in the disconnection of the internet. So cutting off any alternative sources of information for the population. In Western and Russian media, we saw paid commentators, what we suspect were paid commentators, who filled the comment sections of articles on Russia with pro-Russian comments and tried to shout down anyone who had said anything about anything negative about Putin or Russia or Russia's army in Ukraine. Any posts critical of President Putin were supposedly deleted by Odnoklassniki at some point and caused a little bit of a scandal. Odnoklassniki explained that it was in response to increased numbers of user complaints about such posts. I would imagine those are probably those same paid commentators making those complaints. And at the request of the Russian government, and they tried to make it into some big deal that Twitter bowed to their authority, Twitter blocked the account of the nationalist group in Ukraine, well, I guess they are nationalist, Pravi Sektor, on Twitter for all users whose accounts are set to Russia. Now, if you change your account setting, you can still see it. And hackers attacked Cyberbekut, so they're pro-Russian Ukrainian, claimed responsibility for DDoS attacks on the NATO websites, disrupting mobile phone service for neo-fascist groups, that being Pravi Sektor, and that it destroyed Ukraine's Central Elections Committee electronic system 2 days before the presidential election. I don't actually know if they did that. I know that these things, that the NATO sites did go down, and Tymoshenko had her phone hacked and infamously released, but I don't know if they were actually behind it. Other groups claimed responsibility for it, too. So, I mentioned that there were a lot of fakes out there. Pro-Russian internet activists frequently use photos from other contexts and pretend that they are events in Ukraine. Fakes have come from everything from Syria, Africa, Saudi Arabia, Chechnya, Iraq, Nagorno-Karabakh, and even from movies. There's one good example here, a photo circulated of a burning building that was supposedly in Slavyansk, where women and children are dying after bombardment, was actually seen from a Canadian city called Les Magnétiques, I guess, where an oil train had derailed and exploded. And the number of fakes going around has gotten so big that sites are just publishing droves of them at once instead of going one at a time. So this, actually, in the bottom right corner, is one Noah likes. It's the woman on the right is the Ukrainian biathlete who won the gold, I believe, in the last Olympics. And the picture on the left comes from a social media story that went around claiming that our Olympic champion had become a sniper and was killing children. And so she woke up one day to find that she'd been accused of that and was quite obviously very upset. And then we have this fun thing, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Lots of actors. There are actors, paid people, individuals who are appearing in multiple roles in Russian propaganda pieces. So this guy at the bottom left is Andrei Petkov, and he appeared in, I think, three separate pieces of state TV propaganda, and I believe I thought that was on RFERL. One, he was a regular East Ukrainian bystander who went to a protest like you do and got beaten up by the evil bad Pravi sector. And then in another one, shown on a different state channel, he was a German spy who came to Eastern Ukraine with 500,000 euro worth of money for some unnamed political party who got beaten up and has now seen the error of his ways, that kind of thing. And this woman on the right is Maria Zipko, who has appeared in at least two, probably more, videos about events in Eastern Ukraine. And one, she was like an organizer, the bottom one, she's an organizer for a political referendum. And on the top one, she is supposedly a relative of somebody in a completely different city where she claims to be from, who was injured in a Ukrainian attack. And then we have the events from Odessa in 2nd of May, where possibly up to 48 people were killed following fighting between pro-Russian supporters and Ukrainian government supporters. And it is still slightly unclear what exactly happened. BBC kind of came out with a good rundown of what they think happens. But anyway, there are two separate narratives depending on which media sites you look at. If you look at the Russian state media, they say that armed militia fighters from the nationalist Pravi sector attacked a camp of anti-Maidan protesters that were just peacefully demonstrating and forced them to take cover in the trade union building when they burned down their camp. Then Pravi sector set the building afire using Molotov cocktails and beat up anybody who managed to escape from it. There's also a rumor that some sort of toxic substance was released in the building, and yeah, there hasn't been too much report more on that. So a lot of social media users called this into question by using cell phone and video clips, and also footage from Ukrainian TV and independent Russian TV, Dosht, that seems to show that, in fact, the separatist protests in Odessa themselves initiated the violence and attacked an unarmed pro-Ukrainian football fan march. And yes, the football fans were probably nationalists who were marching in demonstration of unity to the game. And then many residents actually tried to help the separatists get out of the building when it was on fire. So BBC kind of came down in the middle and says that the football fans were marching, the anti-Maidan protesters attacked them, they attacked the tent city in revenge, and both sides were throwing Molotov cocktails at the building, and maybe some people got beaten up when they came out of the building, but most of the regular residents of the cities were trying to help people get out. Here's another good one. This is the Facebook page of supposed Igor Rozovsky, the one on the left, who claims to be a 39-year-old Odessa ER doctor, and said he was derided as a Jew and beaten by Ukrainian Nazi radicals while trying to provide medical assistance to the injured pro-Russian protesters. So he wrote this on his Facebook page. In his post, he called the violence worse than the Nazi occupation. So yet again, going back to that World War II narrative. And he asked, why is the whole world silent? Again, a Russian cry in most of their state media is that the whole world is ignoring this point of view and covering it up in favor of the Ukrainian government. The post went viral globally. It even showed up on NBC News and was translated into multiple languages before a social media activist group like Watcher pointed out that, in fact, he doesn't exist and that his page was created just a few hours before this story went out. He has no other posts. And went and probably used a Google image search to find this guy on the right, who is a dentist from the North Caucasus and has nothing to do with the whole thing. So this is not new. This is hardly new at all. It's just a little bit more advanced and more aggressive. In 2008, in the August 2008 war with Georgia, the Russian state press portrayed Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili as Hitler, publicly shamed him with this video that was actually shot by BBC, and proclaimed him mentally unstable and accused him of war crimes such as genocide and being the aggressor against the South Ossetians. In a speech, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin accused Georgian forces of barbaric atrocities like burning people alive and mass executions. And the very next day, a television station kind of parroted that and started running stories like the government of Georgia is fascist, and other Russian TV stations fell in line and dubbed the actions of the Georgian military in South Ossetia as a failed Georgian blitzkrieg. Ooh, more World War II. Putin also used his favorite boogeyman, the USA and the US intelligence services. He concocted this crazy conspiracy story that claimed that some people in the US intelligence community and Republicans had helped Georgia with this attack to increase McCain's chances of winning the presidency. And in the weeks leading up to the war, the Georgian government websites were attacked and disabled, and they put up, you can barely see that, but these are pictures of Saakashvili looking like Hitler, and actually some pictures of Hitler mixed in there. And then a whole year after the war, almost to the day, a very powerful cyber attack against one particular anti-Russian user, Suhumi, brought down all of Facebook, LiveJournal, and a couple other sites for several hours. And the reason they did that is that he had been very negative about Russia's role in that war, did not hold the state line there. So does it work? Yes, and probably no. So according to the independent survey firm Levada Center and state-run SIOM, most Russians get their information from the TV, and they believe it. Putin and United Russia's ratings are the highest ever. I believe that, too. So Tsion says Russians believe that the self-defense forces in Ukraine are genuine local movements and not organized by Russia. And Russians believe that Ukrainian President Pyotr Poroshenko represents the interests of the U.S. and EU plus oligarchs. Maybe they do, because that's what their TV says. But it's not all doom and gloom. I love this picture. And I took this from Global Voices because they had this great picture up there. But so a lot of these laws that we've discussed are so badly, so vaguely written that they're absolutely not possible to enforce systematically. I do think they'll probably be individualized enforcement as they see fit. Internet censorship is definitely a cat and mouse game or a whack-a-mole game. As soon as you get one down, something else springs right back up. And the Russians are actually quite technically sophisticated. So when Alexander Navalny's blog was blacklisted and blocked, one specific user created a network of mirror sites and then cleverly figured out how to get these sites to redirect government, Roskomnadzor, to other government sites. And then if that happens, then their automatic blocking blocks those sites that they're redirected to. So they ended up blocking pro-Kremlin Life News and then eventually would end up blocking themselves, like Roskomnadzor sites, if they kept doing that. Yeah. Another user, or the same user, actually created a Google Chrome extension that automates finding the mirrors for Navalny. And Nosek recommended just simply using RSS feeds because we're not blocked through that. And then, of course, Twitter is easily circumvented by changing your location data.
Thank you. Thank you so much.